Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Uplift Fit Nutrition Radio. I'm your host, Lacey Dunn, registered dietitian, here to spread the scientific knowledge in the world of fitness and nutrition. I'm so excited about today's episode, so make sure you listen in and get ready to learn. Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Uplift Fit Nutrition Radio. I'm so excited today. I have an incredible guest. Her name is Katie Mora. She is Gut Honest Truth, and I'm so stoked to have her on. I found her, started following her a couple months ago, and since then, I am completely and utterly obsessed with her. So, Katie, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. I know you have your own podcast, which is fabulous, by the way. You guys, the link will be in my description. But, Katie, thank you so much for coming on. Can you tell my listeners just a tad bit about who you are, what you do, and what got you so into the gut?
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me. That was an amazing introduction. So my name is Katie Mora, and I am both a fellow registered dietitian and a certified functional medicine practitioner. So as Lacey said, I do have my own podcast, which is on iTunes and Spotify, and I really specialize in the gut. I treat everything, but I do specialize in the gut. So I want it to be some like amazing, miraculous story that is like, this is how I got into functional medicine and all of this. But, you know, honestly, when I grew up in a all healthcare family, you know, I've got like the dentist, the pharmacist, psychiatrist, psychologist, everything just like in my immediate family. And I went to school to become a psychologist, actually. And then when I went to go to apply to grad school, I was kind of interviewing and shadowing people, and I was bored like all the time. I was always bored. So I finally shadowed some dietitians and functional medicine dietitians, and I had the privilege of shadowing at Mark Hyman's office. And I was like the first time like fully captivated and, you know, just entranced with everything going on. And I was like, okay, I think this is what I'm going to do. And so I went, that is the point that I went actually back to school to become an RD and went to the Institute for Functional Medicine. So I kind of went into the RD thing knowing I would never do traditional healthcare. I would always do functional medicine because my mother is actually like, she worked at a functional medicine pharmacy up back in New York. So I kind of was like that kid growing up that like got the echinacea and vitamin C, like when it was cold out, my mom needed to give me something. And I kind of always had it like whispering in my ear. And so when I finally went to the Institute for Functional Medicine, the first course I did was the gut module. And I remember just being like all the like headlights went off and everything triggered. And I like was like, I understand all of this. Like it was like meant to be and everything made sense. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. So that's I wanted amazing. To be cooler, but that was it.
The Institute for Functional Medicine has such incredible trainings. I know I've gotten to go through some of their modules, and It's just fantastic. It completely is worth every single penny.
I agree. I just actually did the second time around. Was in continuing ed. I did the gut module again, even though I'm certified. And I was like, this is still great. Like it was almost to just like reassure myself, but it is. It's a great training to do. And even if you just do one or two, or if you decide to go through like the whole program, it's where I learned a lot of what I do.
Love it. So today I wanted to start off by talking about irritable bowel syndrome, so IBS, you guys. Mm-hmm. And we know, if you follow me, you guys know that I call IBS a BS diagnosis, because it's a diagnosis made off of the Rome 3 criteria, right? Mm-hmm. So, Katie, can you dive into what IBS is and what are the common causes of IBS?
Yeah, so I like that you call it a BS diagnosis. I tend to call it a trash can diagnosis. It just means they don't know what the hell is wrong with you, right? So, it's a valid diagnosis to a degree, but it really doesn't get to the root cause as to like, okay, so why do you have these symptoms, which common symptoms would be like change in bowels from diarrhea, constipation, loose stool, urgency, pain, gas, bloating, the whole shebang. So it just says, okay, you have this and you don't have Crohn's, celiac, IBD, lactose intolerance, whatever. So you get down and you get this irritable bowel syndrome diagnosis, which afflicts like at least 15%. And I think that's a low ball of the worldwide population. And this is sort of like diagnosed after somebody goes through GI and they see a gastroenterologist who runs, you know, potentially like a endoscopy, colonoscopy, if you're lucky, lactose intolerance test, celiac test. And if all that's negative, you just kind of get like slapped the sticker on of IBS. So in my practice, I really like to dive into the root causes of this, like I'm sure you do in yours, Lacey. But so I kind of come down to the main five categories that underlie IBS. So these are like broad categories, which we can dive into. But like one, which everyone hates to address, is chronic stress. Chronic stress is huge. And people, we don't like to accept that as an answer, unfortunately. But it really does affect everything from like our digestive output to our hormone regulation and how well we digest and rest. I like to look at gut infections. So I know we might chat about that, but everything from bacterial infections to parasitic to yeast, things like people have heard of C. diff or H. pylori and SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So I like to look at that as a broad category. And then I look at digestive output a lot. So a lot of people who struggle with IBS have this low digestive output, meaning they're not producing the amount of stomach acid, which is like the conductor of all of your digestion. They don't produce enough of that, or their enzymes, or potentially their bile, which helps with fat digestion. And then you have to look at foods, of course, right? Like we're dietitians, you have to look at sensitivities, allergies, all of that. And then I also like to always look at thyroid and hormone balance, which I know is your little niche over there and specialty. But if your thyroid and your hormones really aren't playing well together, it's going to affect your gut and vice versa. So I look at those big categories and kind of dive into those nodes.
Yes, I love that you are all about that root cause approach. I am the same way. And just so my listeners have a good backstory of that Rome 3 criteria, because this is why I call it the BS diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It's these three criteria are one, improvement with pooping. Yeah. Two, onset of associated changes with frequency of stool. And then three, change in any former appearance of your stool. So that's very generic, right? Yeah. So, you know, the IBS stands for BS diagnosis to me. And we got to figure out what is going on. Is it the gut infections, the food intolerances? Is it the stress? Is it SIBO? Is it candida? Like, what is going on? So let's go from the top down. Let's talk about things that, you know, can impact how we're digesting our food. So you mentioned stomach acid. Let's mm-hmm. talk about the importance of stomach acid and what can go wrong and how that impacts your whole entire gut. Because I think this is, it's so, I don't want to say easy to fix, but it can be. And it's mm-hmm. one of the most important things that we have is proper stomach acid.
Absolutely. So I always tell my patients and clients that like the top two things that cause all, in my opinion, all chronic illness is chronic stress and low stomach acid. It's like the top two things. So low stomach acid, so I always call it the conductor of digestion and kind of your first line of defense towards everything, right? You put things in your mouth all day long, so you're putting parasites, bacteria, all these different things, but they should get killed off when they enter your super acidic stomach, right? They should get killed off, and they shouldn't stand a chance to make it into the small intestine and large intestine to infect it. But when you have that low acid, you don't have that first line of defense anymore. So that's, you're already lowering your immune ability as well as what is even now like taking home in your gut. Outside of that, it actually is the conductor and trigger of all downstream digestion. So it's what kind of stimulates off you to produce your pancreatic enzymes and your bile production. They all get censored from that. So if you don't have that proper, you know, signaling and censoring, you're not going to produce anything as adequately as you should. And then you're going to struggle not just to digest like proteins due to stomach acid, but you'll struggle with carbs and fats and you won't get your micronutrients. And it becomes a, you know, this like downstream issue and it turns into a bigger issue. And there's a lot of misunderstanding around stomach acid because a lot of people with stomach acid issues, meaning low, they often present as though they have too much acid. So they have this like hyperchlorhydria. So they're having too much acid, they're getting reflux, they're getting GERD, ulcerations in the stomach, things like that, that they are used to hearing and are used to being told like take Tums or take a proton pump inhibitor like omeprazole and shut down your acid production. But that's a completely wrong thing to do in most cases. So it's really kind of disturbing the misnomers around it.
Yeah. And then you're continuing to lower your stomach acid. And your immune system needs that acidic environment in order to kill off bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and it's amazing how much all these, the nodes I was talking about, these five, you know, overarching topics, they all interact with each other, right? So if you have chronic stress, like all of the time, like you're in a bad relationship, right? That's a huge one, a bad relationship, and you hate your job. Well, you're going to over time be leading yourself to low stomach acid. Or if you have hypothyroidism, it causes low stomach acid. So you've got that hormone component. They all themselves contribute to your acid production, which then is an issue too. So they all like intermingle.
And it gets it like it becomes a vicious cycle, because once you have that hypothyroidism and you have that low stomach acid, then you're not digesting all your proteins, and then you're developing SIBO, and then you're developing, you know, nutrient deficiencies, B12, zinc, iron, magnesium, copper. And it becomes a vicious cycle of that then causing hypothyroidism. So it's really hard for people when they try and go down the route of like fixing themselves. I say, yeah, like, please do not do that.
People do, or that they, you know, I know you and I are both on the same page with like test, don't guess.
Yeah.
Because people, A, they try to treat themselves all of the time. It's kind of amazing to me. I don't want this to come off wrong, but people, including myself at times, will like much rather spend the money on supplements and things like that versus actually like spending the money upfront on a test or a provider to get the information to not have to spend so much money trying to do it themselves. And it's just like we're placing the stressors in the wrong places.
Yeah, I fully agree. You got to test every single person. And I don't mean to be like so adamant about it, but every single person I've had do a GI map, which mm-hmm. is my absolute favorite for testing, there has been something wrong on it. Whether it's parasite or candida or H. pylori, or even, you know, just seeing that pancreatic elastase be in the trash, there is always something there.
And all these conditions, like when we get into gut infections, they all have like overlapping symptoms, which is why you get this trash can diagnosis, right? So it's like, we can say, oh, I have gas and bloating, I probably have SIBO, but like, maybe you don't. Maybe you have CFO, which is fungal overgrowth, or maybe you have a parasite, or maybe you just have your elastases in the trash, like you said. So you're improperly digesting. So it's just like, it's better to know.
Yeah. Yes. So I was going to dive into a little bit something on stomach acid, but I want to pause before I do that. And I want to talk about the difference between CFO and SIBO, because people get it mixed up and they think they're the same and they're not.
They do. Someone actually just asked me that like yesterday. So SIBO, right, is bacteria, and CFO is coming from fungus. So usually candida. So like a lot of people have heard of candida albicans. There's plenty of other candidas out there that are like yeast strains that can cause it. But the way you treat those things, both dietarily and causes potentially, and also the herbal products or medications that you use would be different. So I think people need to realize that you do not treat them the same.
No,
an interesting thing for that, though, is there is, they often go hand in hand. And like, there's a lot of, you can make more of an assumption, because you can't test SIBO, right? You can't test it. So that's a problem. Somebody would have to go in and actually scope in there to see the fungus. You can assume it based on symptomology and all of that. Or if somebody has like methane SIBO, methane dominant, they often go hand to hand because they promote each other's growth. So you can sort of assume in that scenario.
I love it. I love it. So in regards to going back to stomach acid, so what are the best ways that people can help test for their stomach acid? I know you put a good handy dandy, the baking soda toast today. So let's talk about those top things that you can do to test your stomach acid.
Yeah, there's probably three top ways that I like. There's other ways as well. Two are readily available. One is not. The baking soda test is super benign and easy, right? You have to just go get like fresh baking soda, like Arm & Hammer fresh baking soda. And then you're going to take a quarter teaspoon into like 6 to 8 ounces of lukewarm water right when you wake up first thing in the morning, and you're going to drink it. And you're basically literally just waiting to see how long it takes you to start belching. Is it a couple minutes? Is it 3, 4, 5 minutes? Or is it like past 5 minutes? Because if it's past 5 minutes, you start to be like, okay, something's going on with my stomach acid, meaning it's low. If it happens very quickly, that's great. That's a great sign. So that's like a very benign thing, which is why I put out into the social media world, like you can do this without much harm, right? It's not my favorite way to do it. It's just the most readily available and safe. Then there's the betaine hydrochloric acid challenge, which is probably what I use the most. This I would do under the supervision of someone, but this is, it never opened those capsules. That is something I always tell people, because people who don't swallow pills tend to do that and it will burn your esophagus. Do not do this. But it's basically just a titration method, right? You're starting with a capsule of X amount of hydrochloric acid, which is something you're making endogenously, meaning within. You're making this within, you're just taking an external source in this circumstance. And you're taking one couple minutes, depending, before protein meals, because stomach acid, right, is intended to digest your protein. And you're going to do this breakfast, lunch, dinner. And for signs of discomfort, so acid reflux, cramping, pain, anything that would be abnormal, the problem here becomes, if you're already somebody with IBS, you're already in abnormal land, right? So in this circumstance, you're actually looking for improvement. So if you start taking the capsules and you're starting to actually feel less crappy, it's a good thing. So it gets a little confusing, which is why I recommend you work with like a dietitian on this. But you're just increasing one capsule per meal, two capsule, up to five or six, depending, until you feel that discomfort. And then you're going to start to back down. So I kind of call it like a little slap to your gut's face, like telling your gut, like, wake up and do your job. And it's going to start doing it on its own again. So you start to wean off over time.
Yes, yes, yes. Always want to wean that off. Yeah. You don't want to be stuck on that for life. I'm curious, what is the max number of pills you've had somebody take before?
That I've had someone, or that someone came to me and said I went to this number. I usually stop at six because I just feel like it's a lot of acid. I've had people come back like not feeling anything at like 10.
Same. It's mind-blowing. Yeah.
It's so low, then it just between everything they got going on. There's someone like that is who would benefit from doing a Heidelberg test. So it's hard to get access to the Heidelberg test. I used to work at a clinic that used it. But basically that's just where you swallow a capsule and they either tether it with like a string or just kind of you poop it out. And it goes through and actually tests how long it takes your body to like reacidify after drinking like a bicarb substance. It's a bit more functional, but honestly, in the end of that, the outcome is still take hydrochloric acid. So I don't always think it's a necessity, if you will.
Gotcha. Yeah. And it's an expensive test. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So it's not as available to your average person or our listeners here, probably.
Now let's talk a little bit about H. pylori, because we know that low stomach acid can also be because of H. pylori being a demon on your health. So you guys, H. pylori is a natural and normal inhabitant in your stomach, but it's when it's overgrown that it causes health chaos. So why does H. pylori, you know, cause health chaos? Well, of course, we talked about the low stomach acid, but it also can develop ulcers and lead to gastric cancers. And it leads to these nutrition deficiencies. We talked about the payment. So with H. pylori here, let's talk about the most common symptoms with this.
Yeah. So first of all, I nerd out on H. pylori so much. I'm like obsessed with it.
I don't know why I'm obsessed with it. Probably because almost every single person I've tested has H. pylori.
Well, it's so fascinating. So it's, I used to not worry about it. And I treat everyone now. I mean, it's common in over 50% of the population worldwide, and it can be transferred through saliva. So I see it, I treat couples a lot, and you're passing it through the family, right? So you treat one person, you need to treat the other person in the family, usually, not always, but like 90% of the time. But H. pylori has a slew of symptoms, but the most common ones you'll hear of are like nausea, loss of appetite, a lot of burping and bloating. A lot of people struggle to gain weight when they have H. pylori. And a lot of people have like this almost like a gnawing pit, and it's usually worse away from food. So not when you eat. So not typical IBS, like right when you eat, you feel sick. So you can kind of go through the body, just so you know, like the stomach acid. Hints around that would be like within 30 minutes of eating, you're getting gassy and bloated. H. pylori, hours away from it, you're usually feeling nauseous or having pain.
Yes, yes. And I see a lot of undigested food in the stool.
Mm-hmm.
Acne. And then, of course, we have that heartburn or reflux and even bad breath. I know some people have that like they have that weird feeling in their mouth as well. Not dry mouth, but just like a weird, like,
it's smell. Coming from the reflux. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are things to look for with the H. pylori.
H. pylori is fascinating. Just so, like, every time there's some weird condition someone has that you've, like, never heard of and, like, 12 doctors have tried to treat, I start finding, like, 12 research articles on H. pylori and the connection. It's, like, amazing.
It's incredible. And it has a best friend called Candida.
Yep. The little masquerader over there.
Yes, they like to be very best friends. So Candida, again, is actually naturally in your gut. It's a essentially, it's a yeast, and when it's overgrown, it rears its ugly head. So with Candida, we went over, you know, SIFO. Candida can be categorized into SIFO when it's concentrated in that small intestine. You can also have Candida go in other places. So it can actually cause, like, fungal acne and dermatitis on your scalp. So it, and also, of course, yeast infections, UTIs. But with Candida, it likes to have its best friend, H. pylori, which I find so, so interesting. And I'm curious, because I have not looked into why they're best friends. Do you know why they're best friends?
I actually don't, but if I had to go on, like, physiological properties, I would say it's probably the biofilm formation they form together, which makes them both very hard to treat, right? So right. I can explain what a biofilm is if no one, I don't know what the, if you've talked about that prior, but it's basically, I like to think of it like, I think of it personally like brick walls that are built around different things in the gut. So things meaning it can actually build, bacteria and yeast will form them to protect themselves. And it can keep things like heavy metals in there, other parasites in there, other bacteria. And sometimes the biofilm, like what's within, is fine, right? It, maybe H. pylori is in there and Candida's covering it. And it can be okay sometimes when it's in there, as long as the immune system's regulated. But once we pop those biofilms or the immune system gets out of whack, everything sort of like comes out and is at free play. And a lot of things you didn't know you had before start to show. And then the immune system doesn't know what to do with it.
I like to think of it kind of like a swampy area, and you have that like film on that swamp that has all those disgusting little critters and bugs and nasties with algae. That's what I think of when I think of biofilm. But you know, the crazy thing with those biofilms is a lot of practitioners, or I see a lot of different practitioners, not try and break those apart. And if you don't break out that biofilm, then you're not getting what could be hiding down in there. There could be a parasite that's hiding down in that biofilm, and the H. pylori and Candida is actually preventing it from being able to be seen. And once you break through, you get rid of the H. pylori, you get rid of the Candida, and you break through that biofilm, then you see other things come up.
Absolutely. I always tell patients too, when I'm like testing them with diagnostic solutions, I use their GI map a lot, and I'll test them, and I'll be like, I wouldn't be surprised when we test in X amount of months or whatever again, if new stuff starts to come out because they were hiding within those biofilms. So you'll start to see like parasites and stuff start to show their head on the next test, and you're like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. And that's why sometimes you feel worse sometimes before you get better. So you might, you know, with healing, it goes up and down and up and down. Well, that's because you might be killing off and then something is actually erupting that was hidden.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very tricky, which this is all the reasons too, why working with someone and like not treating yourself is so important, because you just, there's so much overlap in there and you don't know what you're triggering and not when you start treating.
So we talked about testing. So for H. pylori and Candida, you can go down the route of the GI map. Mm-hmm. H. pylori, you can also go down the route of the biopsy, endoscopy. That's like, to me, I'd rather not go down that route. You can also do the breath test, but I kid you not, I have seen the breath test not actually catch pylori so many times.
I test both. So I would do breath testing and stool testing antigen for this. And they're different, right? They're different mechanisms of testing. So I get that question a lot, but they're all different mechanisms of testing, including obviously a biopsy. But in a biopsy, like people are always like, oh, gold standard is like getting someone in there in a biopsy, but they're only pulling from certain areas. And H. pylori can infect anywhere, literally anywhere in your body. It can affect your ear canal, it can affect your sinuses. So it can affect your stomach, it can affect your intestines. So it's not just a stomach issue that we think of with that. And people, that's all we usually have a conversation around, is like, it causes stomach ulcers. Well, it causes a lot more than that. So I do both, but the breath test is almost always negative. Always. And I find a lot of gastroenterologists, when they scope people, they miss H. pylori. And then I find it on the stool test.
Yes, yes. And with the stool test, it's also hard because it's that H. pylori is having to travel through the gut, right? So it could actually be more elevated in the stomach, but as it's getting into the stool, it's less concentrated. So just things to kind of think about for other people. And when it comes down to candida, of course, you can do the GI map. I see it catch it all the time, but you can also do candida antibodies in the blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The thing that's like a pros and cons, right? It's going to readily catch it, but it's also going to stay elevated for a long time in the blood if you've had that infection. So it gets harder when you're like, for treating purposes, it's harder. Do you know what I mean? Like if you're treating someone, you're trying to see if it's coming down, it's going to stay elevated for a really long time.
Right, right.
So that's the only con for a provider more so.
Now let's talk a little bit about, so we talked about, you know, candida and H. pylori, and then we're rolling down into, you know, the SIFO, the SIBO. So I'm curious to hear, what do you see most in your practice?
H. pylori, but I see a lot of H. pylori, a lot of SIBO. That's probably my honest specialty outside of H. pylori is I feel like SIBO all day long.
I love it. I do too.
Yeah.
I see both.
It's just, you know, it's so common, unfortunately.
Now, what are the top contributors to SIBO here?
Yeah. So I, you know, falling within kind of that broader category we talked about, there's six main causes. I'm sure there's plenty of others, but six main root causes of SIBO. So stress is still one of those. And the digestive output, like the stomach acid, is one of those. But then we add a few new ones in. So SIBO is a motility issue, right? So slowed motility due to whatever cause is the problem, meaning things aren't moving and clearing through like they should. So motility is always got to be addressed when it comes to SIBO. Adhesions is such an overlooked thing when it comes to SIBO. And it's hard because not every practitioner, including myself, can address that. But adhesions, meaning scar tissue. So that can be, you can get scar tissue without surgery. You can just get it from the way we hold our stress, the way we sit and turn and are born and genetics. So that's one thing. But people, especially women who have had like cesarean C-sections or have had any kind of, you know, gastric bypass, or they've had gallbladder removal or even appendix, there can be a scar tissue adhesion. So I always say, think of it like a gardening hose, right? Like what happens when you get a kink in your watering hose? Nothing flows through like it should. And so you need to be able to untie that kink so that things can move properly through. So I always recommend people work with like a myofascial release expert who can do visceral and like adhesion on their gut, just to even rule out this as part of the problem, because you're going to have a really hard time if you do, let's say you've had two C-sections and you have SIBO and it's a big cause of it. You can give it all the antimicrobials you want, but within the next year, you're going to get it again. So you need someone to remove the scar tissue or like break it down more. And then medications is huge. So medications is super overlooked. So a lot of people know the connection of like, right, proton pump inhibitors. So acid reducers, shutting your stomach acid down. There's a lot of connection with like morphine and codeine use. Even literally one time morphine and codeine use can contribute to SIBO. But actually the number one contributor in research above everything I've talked about is being on levothyroxine. So which is the number one prescribed thyroid medication, as you know, also known as Synthroid. But this is the number one contributor to causation of SIBO. And that is not commonly known, even in the functional medicine world.
No, I honestly, and I work with thyroid medications all the time. I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I've done, when you specialize in SIBO, you do a lot of research. And I kept finding this trend. And I finally looked into the research and was like, holy crap. But it's the, even, so they took a group, basically, they did research and they took hypothyroid patients that were not medicated, and then levothyroxine patients that were medicated, and looked at the differences and stuff. And the people who were not medicated and have hypothyroidism had much less prevalence of SIBO And it's interesting, right? Because you would think you're giving someone levothyroxine to improve their motility due to the slow, like a lot of people, you know, with hypothyroidism have constipation issues and slowed motility. So you would think, okay, we're given a medication and things are moving better. We're fixing it. But that's not the case. What happens, and this isn't a very well understood thing yet, but really what happens is in a state of inflammation in the gut, which, right, SIBO, you take the medication and it's T4, right? So you're taking the thyroid hormone T4, and it's naturally, like a doctor would give you T4 and assume it's going to go down the whole pathway and get converted into T3, which is the active thyroid hormone. But there's also this tricky little thing you know about called reverse T3, which is like slamming on the brake of the thyroid. All it is the T3 flipping over. And what happens is when you take the T4 in that state of inflammation is it constantly gets flipped into reverse T3. So if you're not checking someone's reverse T3 that you have on levothyroxine, especially a SIBO patient, you're going to be in trouble because you're going to always find that RT3 is high. So you're putting a hypothyroid patient just in another version of hypothyroidism.
Yeah, because that reverse T3 competes with that T3 and it's not going to work. It's mm-hmm. not.
You're literally taking away their active hormone, putting the brakes on. And it's just interesting. I have found that with most of my, I do want to back up and say, like, just because you're on levothyroxine does not mean you will develop SIBO or that you have it or that it's not the right medication for you. All I'm saying is you need to work with someone that properly tests thyroid panels in order to make sure.
Yeah, I fully agree. I work with thyroid all the time. Hashimoto's, hypothyroidism. And we always test, we don't guess. I was like, I should trademark that. Somebody already trademarked it.
Did they? Of course. Classic. But you should. It might be interesting if you look back at any like more of the challenging like SIBO patients you've had, if there's been like any hiccups and not being able to get them well and just see like, were they on levo and, you know, to try to take a look back at the data.
Yeah, I know a lot of my patients that have had issues with recurrent SIBO, it's been intestinal adhesions or a motility disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, foodborne illness, which I skipped over to, I don't know why that was my next one, but foodborne illness is
demon. Yes.
That one's the worst. I mean, obviously, right? Levothyroxine is the number one causative fact that they find. It's correlation, not so much causative. You can't really say anything's causative, but, there's other medications, right? There's other ways to fix the thyroid, but foodborne illness causes something called autoimmune SIBO. And that is something you don't want. There's a test called IBS Smart or IBS Sure by Vibrant America, that tests for this. And it's literally looking at, your body producing antibodies based. So I don't know if we know what molecular mimicry is and how autoimmunity works. I'm sure you've talked about it with your listeners.
Oh.
But basically, right, the body is mistaking something else for itself and attacking it. And in this case, let's say somebody got salmonella poisoning and foodborne illness 10 years ago, and they got really sick, right? They very clearly like remember that. They start to release something called CDTB. So this comes out and it looks like something called vinculin. Vinculin is a protein that regulates our motility in our gut. So what starts to happen when our body sees that is we produce anti-vinculin. And when we have the CDTB coming out, we're producing it, and we start producing anti-vinculin, you start to get nerve damage. And when you get nerve damage in the gut, that motility aspect, it just goes into the trash, right? It doesn't work well. Things don't clear and they don't know how to fix this yet. There's a lot of different things you can do to help support it. But this is like one of those things where I tell patients to get checked as an emotional aspect because you may not get rid of it. That may be one of those circumstances where you do have to live with IBS, but you can constantly be doing things to support yourself and minimizing the symptoms until they can figure out the true fix there.
Love it. And I would say the last thing that we just need to make a note on, because it can be a root cause of a lot of issues, is intestinal permeability, aka quote unquote leaky gut. So you guys, think of your gut lining like your front door. You want the good guys to come in and you want the bad guys to stay out. And what happens with that heightened intestinal permeability is you have increased what's called lipopolysaccharides in your gut, which is allowing essentially a bunch of different inflammation and poor bacteria coming into your body and causing havoc in your entire system. And then you have low immune system because 80% of your immune system is in your gut. And then you're contracting all these different, you know, these viruses, these parasites, you're getting sick often. And it really just stops you from ever being able to even combat any of these different pathogens.
Yeah. Leaky gut is so interesting, right? So, I obviously treat a lot of that. It kind of is one of those things that goes hand in hand with everything. And SIBO is one of the top, SIBO and gluten are the top two causes of leaky gut. So they're very close knit there, but I have my only pet peeve around leaky gut in the holistic functional medicine world is that practitioners, and maybe you've seen me post on this, is like me and my soapbox now, but we post a lot about products and leaky gut and how it affects us. And it's all super valid and accurate. And there's a lot of research on it. So for the traditional people out there, look at the research. But it gets patients and clients really thinking too much about the leaky gut versus those causes. And right, like you can have leaky gut, let's just say due to SIBO, because we're on the topic. And if I don't get rid of the SIBO, I'm never going to fix the leaky gut. So it doesn't matter how much glutamine and zinc carnosine and stuff I'm throwing at it, I'm probably not going to fix it. I might make myself feel a little bit better, but you're not going to fix it. So I like the conversation with practitioners to change a little bit more and like getting our clients and patients more on track with like, okay, let me care about the foods and the stressors and all of that so I can permanently have my gut lining be working.
But that's, we definitely need that gut lining. Yeah. Stay on that soapbox.
That's my soapbox. It matters. It's valid. And everything that Lacey just said is like, it is the big trigger for a lot of this stuff, but it's like, why do you have it in the first place?
Exactly. You have to address the why or you're not going to get rid of it.
Exactly. Which is why working with someone like you is like great, because you're looking at their thyroid and their hormones and their stressors and their gut and saying, and diet and like what is what and what is the specific cause for you.
And I just want to say this because I know a lot of people, I know SIBO, Candida, H. pylori, all these gut issues, you know, ulcerative colitis, IBD, they're very hard, right? And they're very stressful. But what I see holds most people back from healing is pressuring themselves into healing. And if you're doing that and you're putting more stress on yourself, focusing on, I need to heal by X amount of time, you're not going to heal. Your body senses that stress and you are keeping yourself in that downward spiral of not getting better with all that stress. So you guys, the best thing that you can do to heal is let your body heal on its own time. Trust your practitioner, trust your body, keep going after what the root cause is, right? Keep doing what's in your power, but don't try and heal at X amount of time. Don't try and rush the process. Let your body heal at its own time.
I love that so much because it's so true. And, you know, we've all been there, but it's true. Or like you see it around diet, especially, right? Like you try to do anything and you can see just like the fear and the frustration and like the frankly, just being like pissed about being on a diet and stuff. You're like, this isn't worth it. Like this, you need to be like in a space where it's like safe and you're ready and you can make the changes that are appropriate for you, because you can heal a lot of these things without, you know, overwhelming yourself too much. And also over time, time is, you know, be in it for the long haul.
I love it. So I want to hear from you. What are your top three tips for maintaining a healthy gut?
Ooh, oh my gosh. Okay. I have to think about this
question,
one.
Right?
There's so many, right? So top three tips for, you know, I feel like I'm going to say things that people aren't going to be like, take probiotics, but I'm actually not a huge probiotic person sometimes. But honestly, like stress around eating is huge. So I don't even work that much alongside like intuitive eating and stuff, but like taking a moment before you eat, or if you're super stressed out, not eating on the go, because your body's constantly in fight or flight, right? So our bodies do not understand the difference between being back on the Serengeti with a tiger about to maul my face off, or being at my job where my boss yells at me all day. And if I'm at my or I'm in this bad relationship and my wife is yelling at me all day and nagging me, well, my body senses that as fight or flight. And it's like, oh my God, the tiger is going to get me. So all of the blood flow that should be going to my gut for digestion is now going to my extremities so I can run away or fight. So people don't realize that. And we eat all the time when we're stressed out. Like, stress eating is literally a buzzword. So taking a moment and whatever you got to do, sit down at a table and like think, and like, that's huge. And kind of along those lines, I would actually, this one I'm horrible at personally, but chewing well, like, oh my God, it's so underrated. Like, people scarf their food down, including myself, and it's horrible. And you have to think about, like, you should have, like, what is it, like 32 chews, which is ridiculous, but 32 chews per bite.
Yeah, I'm never reaching that.
Yeah. Like, we're lucky if I get to 10 here. But if we're not doing that, this is how a lot of this happens, right? We're eating out, we're eating when we're stressed, and then we're not chewing well at all. And then large food chunks are making it past that low stomach acid, infecting the intestines, and then that bacteria and yeast are having a field day, right? It's like a feeding frenzy. So chewing well, stress around food. And then a third one, oh my goodness. I honestly would say to test your stomach acid like every 6 months to a year, if you're not doing more regularly, like, because that is so important. And I do it to myself regularly just to like check on things. You're like, oh gosh, it's low. Like, I need some support, because you'd rather like nip that in the bud than keep going years before you're in a state of sickness. I thought none of those through, just so you know. Here you go.
Honestly, I am to the point where I would even say get your gut tested once a year at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
Do a GI map once a year.
Especially if you've had SIBO or you've had like parasites or anything. Like, yeah, I tell people like every 6 months to a year, repeat, depending on how long you've been well for, repeat that test. Why not? Why not do that? That is preventative medicine. Why would we not?
Now, I'm going to throw something at you, because this has been increasingly, at least it's increasingly on my Instagram feed, and it's parasite cleanses.
Oh.
Without knowing you have a parasite. So yeah. I'll hear your thoughts, because I honestly have been digging into all this, and it's scary yet fascinating.
So yeah, this is what I mean. People like to sell product, right? So people sell product because we love product and we're always on social media and it catches our attention. But it's not good, right? So there's like a great one is like the Mimosa Pudica, right? People take that. That's just like such a benign thing. It can be great, but it also can take a lot of your mucosal layer out with you. And people think they have like worms all the time coming out, and it's literally like you're shedding your intestines, and that's not good. So I never think someone should do those things. Like, if you have worked with someone before on with some herbals and you know how you tolerate them and your stomach's a little off, like, I think doing, you know, a 4 to 6 week stint just to see if it helps of something like, let's say, oregano oil, just to get yourself back kind of in check, that can be fine if you've done this before. But like doing a whole series of like, let me just destroy my microbiome without knowing, I don't know. You probably have read way more about those than I have.
I have definitely looked into, you know, the parasite cleanses, what it does, why I should do it. And the basis is that these practitioners are saying, or, you know, the supplement companies are saying that everybody has a parasite. And I think that is definitely not the case. Not everybody has a parasite. But I do think if you are suffering with chronic issues and you've gone down the route of all this testing, you've done a GI map, there's nothing there, you're struggling with issues, you've done mobility testing, you've looked at intestinal adhesions, and you're still struggling, then yes, this might be a great cleanse to do, because those parasites can't always be picked up by different testing, right? The GI map only tests a couple. So I think there is a case for it. I always love throwing controversial stuff in. Sorry.
No, I like it, because it's interesting to hear what people think. Because I think there is a case for it, but I also think, right. So it's estimated what, like 80% of people have a parasite. But the thing is, not all parasites are bad. A lot of them just like live alongside our gut in harmony, and some even help us. I mean, there's even, I do not do this, but there's like, think of like giving people hookworms and, you know, and different worms to change their immune system and regulate them to heal them from Crohn's disease and stuff like that. Like there's a lot of research behind that. So a lot of people do have, you know, parasites and worms, and they're okay being there. It's just when you have these symptoms or they overhaul or something like that, that it becomes a problem in many cases. So you don't really know what you're getting rid of. You know what I mean? The problem is too, people do that with SIBO and stuff all the time. Even when my patients like, which I get it because testing is expensive, it adds up over time, but so does healthcare. But if you're people are like, I know it's back. And then they just keep treating themselves and treating themselves. And it's like, we don't even know what we're treating anymore. And maybe you caused such a yeast infection from killing all the bacteria because they balance each other. And now we're just killing it more and more and getting you sicker in a different way. So I obviously love testing. I've done this long enough to be able to do a lot without testing, and kind of it's all I do all day long. But I could see where it serves a purpose. But I can also see where people make themselves sicker.
Yes, that's for sure. Well, I'm all about, you guys know my experimentations. So I will keep you guys updated. I am doing my own parasite cleanse.
Which one are you doing? Can you tell me?
Yeah, of course. I'm doing the microbiome formulas, which if anybody knows, is the same exact thing as CellCore Biosciences. So I will keep you guys updated on how that goes.
Yeah, if that's good. I've tried the Mimosa Pudica. I like to try everything. I always like to try everything on myself before I tell people to do it.
I'm terrible. Which, I am such an experimentation person.
I am too. Well, it's the best way to learn and be, you know, I find it puts you at a different level with as a provider when you're able to speak to the experience. So I've worked with so many providers over my time that have never even done like a simple thing like gluten elimination or something. And I'm like, how can you tell your patients to do this if you've never even experienced like the amazing benefits or the horrible time you had doing it? Like, so I love it. I try everything. I have the Mimosa Pudica still. So I obviously didn't finish that one out. Didn't work.
Well, thank you so much for being so open, honest, transparent. I greatly appreciate you, girlfriend. So can you tell my listeners where they can find you, where they can follow you, and then where they can check your awesome podcast out?
Yeah. So my website is guthonesttruth.com. And there's a tab up there. You can work with me or check out my blogs or my podcast or my eBooks, where I go into all of this information we just talked about in depth. And for practitioners, I do a practitioner guides as well. And then you can email me guthonesttruth@gmail.com. And then my Instagram handle is @guthonesttruth. You can find me through Lacey maybe. Follow me. Tell me what you like to hear, because I like to, as it is, the gut honest truth. I like to just come out and blatantly tell you what I think. No hold back.
I love it so much. I love it. Well, thank you so, so much for your time. You guys, all her info is going to be in the description below. And then thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. If you liked it, if you loved it, leave a review, share it. This is how this podcast grows and reaches more people. And if you did not know, once this podcast reaches 500 reviews, I am going to give away a free month of premium coaching. So get ready, leave those reviews. And thank you so much again for coming on my podcast.
Thank you. This was amazing. Keep doing amazing things, and definitely someone get that coaching.